Thus have I heard. 2,500 years ago in northern India, there lived a young man of the Gotama clan. We actually don't know his first name. Many centuries later, he was called Siddhartha Gotama, but that appears to be not his real name. Siddhartha means the accomplished one, and it only shows up in the literature about 400 years after Mr. Gotama's death. But we can call him Siddhartha Gotama because that's what most people know him as. Siddhartha Gotama was born into a prominent family of the Sakyans in the foothills of the Himalayas. When he was 29 years old, though, he left his family and headed south to seek his spiritual fortune. India at that time had undergone basically an agricultural revolution. They were able to produce more food than was necessary to feed the people producing the food, so they had a surplus. This meant that they could afford to support people like full-time spiritual seekers. Of course, it also meant they could support standing armies. You win some, you lose some. So India at that time was literally crawling with spiritual seekers. And so Siddhartha Gotama went south and east to the land of the Kalamas. And there he studied with Alara Kalama. And he learned Alara Kalama's teachings. He also learned his meditation practice, which culminated in what we know as the seventh jhana, the realm of no-thingness. Alara Kalama was very impressed with Siddhartha Gotama and eventually said, "What I know, you know. What you know, I know. Come, let us lead this group together." But actually, Siddhartha Gotama was interested in, well, finding peace, finding out how to deal with old age, sickness, and death, finding out how to deal with dukkha. So he left. He traveled further south to the kingdom of Magadha. And there he studied with Udaka Ramaputta, Udaka the son of Rama. It appears that Rama was a teacher that Udaka had learned from, and the Buddha was able to learn Rama's doctrine and Rama's practices, meditation practices, which culminated in the eighth jhana, the realm of neither perception or non-perception. And Udaka was so impressed, he said, "You know Rama's doctrine and teachings as well as Rama did. You should lead this group." But once again, Siddhartha Gotama had not found his answer to his spiritual quest. He'd only learned the eighth jhana. So he left. He spent the next probably several years doing austerity practices, doing things like the breathless meditation. This was meditation where you hold your breath for as long as you can. What he discovered is that if you spend a lot of time holding your breath, it gives you terrible headaches. But it didn't answer his questions. So he quit doing that practice, and he started taking very little food. Eventually, he was living on one grain of rice a day. And what he discovered, if you eat one grain of rice a day, is you get very skinny and have a tendency to fall down. It still didn't answer his question. So, 6 years after he left home, he decided, "I got to do something else. This isn't working." And so, trying to figure something else to do, he remembered an incident from his childhood. He had been sitting under a rose apple tree while his father was working. His father was probably a farmer. So he's sitting there under the rose apple tree, and he falls into the first jhana. And now, 25 years later, he thinks back on this and says, "Why should I be afraid of the pleasure that rose from that jhana? It's not connected with sensuality. It seems to be a pure pleasure." He thought about it some more, and he thought, I'm not afraid of that pleasure. Could these jhanas be the way to awakening? And then with more reflection, he decided, yes, this is the way to awakening. But he was in such a sorry state from having lived on one grain of rice a day, he didn't have the strength to undertake jhana practice. So he began eating solid food. Now at that time, there were five other practitioners, austerity practitioners, who had been practicing with him. And when they saw that he was eating solid food, they thought he had returned to the life of luxury and given up the spiritual path. And so they left in disgust. But Siddhartha Gautama hadn't given up the spiritual path. He was just trying to find something that worked. And so he spent some period of time, we don't know how long, probably a few weeks to a few months, regaining his strength. And then one full moon night in May, he sat down under a tree and had the determination he was going to figure it out, or he was going to stay there till the flesh rotted from his bones. So he moved through the four jhanas. 1, 2, 3, 4. And then, with his mind concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, in the first watch of the night, he remembered past lives. And in the second watch of the night, with his mind still concentrated, clear, sharp, bright, malleable, wieldy, and given to imperturbability, he could see beings passing away and re-arising according to their karma. And in the third watch of the night, he was able to formulate what we have come to know as the Four Noble Truths, or perhaps more accurately translated, the Four Ennobling Truths. These are truths that in and of themselves are not noble, but if you understand them and practice them, they will make you noble. So they are ennobling truths. He spent the next 7 weeks in the vicinity of this Bodhi tree, the tree of awakening, trying to decide, could he teach what he had learned? It was very subtle. It wasn't obvious. The suttas tell us that eventually he decided that what he had learned was too difficult. I understood. This Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in its lifestyle, takes delight in its lifestyle, rejoices in its lifestyle. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth. This, that conditionality dependent origination. Idapachayata paticchasamuppada. It would appear that the Buddha felt that this was the key thing that you needed to see, you needed to understand, if you were going to understand what he had come to understand. He also said, and it's hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all fabrication, the relinquishment of all the cool things of one's lifestyle, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. These appear to be the other important aspects of what he had learned. The stilling of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all the cool things of one's lifestyle. Right? The destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to teach this Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be for me wearying and troublesome. Therefore, he decided not to teach. Now, the sutta goes on to say that at that point, one of the highest of the Brahma gods, realizing that the newly awakened Buddha was disinclined to teach, as quickly as a strong man could extend his arm or draw it back, disappeared from the highest of the heavens and reappeared on earth before the newly awakened Buddha. This Brahma god, Sahampati, got down on one knee, put his hands together in reverential salutation, and begged the Buddha to teach for the benefit of gods and humans. He said, "There are some with little dust in their eyes. They will be able to understand what you have come to understand." And so the Buddha looked around with the eye of a Buddha, and he could see some people with much dust in their eyes, and he could see some with a middle amount of dust in their eyes, and he could see a few with little dust in their eyes. And he thought, maybe I should try and teach those with a little dust in their eyes. And then that Brahma god, Sahampati, realizing that he had enabled the Buddha to teach, as quickly as a strong man could extend his arm or draw it back, disappeared from the human realm and reappeared in the highest of the heavens. The Buddha thought, now, who should I try and teach? He remembered his first teacher, Alara Kalama, and he thought, he has little dust in his eyes, but unfortunately, Alara Kalama had recently died. And then he thought about Uddaka Ramaputta, and he has little dust in his eyes, but he too had recently died. And then the Buddha thought about his five friends, the ones who had been practicing austerities with him. It seemed maybe they had little dust in their eyes. Perhaps he should try and teach them. And so again, with the eye of the Buddha, he surveyed the world and he could see that his five friends had headed west to near the great city of Varanasi, to the village of Sarnath, and were staying in the deer park there at Isipatana. So he set out, walking in that direction. It says that at one point along the way, he encountered an ajivaka. Now, the ajivakas were members of another religion that was flourishing at that time. And this ajivaka was struck by the Buddha's appearance. He stopped the Buddha and he said, "You don't look like ordinary people. You have this glow about you. Who is your teacher?" The Buddha replied, "I have no teacher. I'm awake." And that ajivaka said, "May it be so, may it be so," and pass by on the other side. Buddha's first attempt at teaching didn't go over real well. But he continued on west, and eventually he came to Sarnath, to the deer park at Isipatana. And his friends saw him coming in the distance, and they said, "Oh, look, it's Sid the Slacker. Well, we'll let him sit with us, but we won't show him any deference or anything." But when he drew near, he had such a radiance that one of his friends went and took his robe and bowl, and another got water for him to wash his feet, and a third prepared a seat for him to sit on. And after he had sat down and washed his feet, he said, "Well, guys, I figured it out." And they laughed, and they said, "You didn't figure nothing out. We saw you. You resorted to the life of luxury." He said, No. I did figure it out." They said, "But you couldn't have. We saw you. You were eating. You gave up the spiritual path." He said, "No, I didn't give up the spiritual path. I just started doing something that works. Look, have I ever told you before that I figured it out?" Well, they had to admit he'd never made such a claim before, so they agreed to listen. And he taught them what we now know as the Dhamma Chakra Pavadana Sutta, the discourse setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma. In that sutta, he talked about these four ennobling truths and the Eightfold Path. The first of these ennobling truths is dukkha happens. In America, they used to put that on bumper stickers. Well, they used a four-letter Anglo-Saxon word rather than dukkha, but same idea. Things go wrong. The word dukkha is actually quite interesting. Dukkha would literally be translated as bad space or dirty hole, referring to the axle hole in a wooden wheel. If it gets, you put oil, you put grease in there so it'll turn, and if it gets rocks in there, then you have a dirty hole and you have a very unpleasant ride. So, dukkha. Often you see dukkha translated as, well, suffering. And true, all suffering is dukkha, but dukkha is actually a broader term. A better translation would be unsatisfactoriness. I personally like the old American hippie slang of bummer. A bummer is something that bums you out. And this is really important because dukkha is not out there. Dukkha is your response to what you're experiencing. It's like, I went to the beach, man, and lost my sunglasses. Well, don't get all bummed out. It was only sunglasses, right? If you lose your sunglasses and you think, well, I hope who finds them has a better use for them than I do, no problem. If you get all upset, oh, those were my favorite sunglasses, then it's a bummer, right? And you're experiencing dukkha. So this is a very important aspect of dukkha, is that it's your reaction to what's going on. Now, what's going on that causes you to experience this dukkha has actually been addressed by modern science. Modern science points out that the world that we live in is beset by entropy. Entropy is a tendency for things to go from a state of order to disorder. If I take this glass and I drop it on the floor, it breaks into pieces, right? If I take the pieces and drop them on the floor, not likely to break into a glass, right? You might have noticed this entropy happening in your life, right? You clean your house, and 2 weeks later, somebody's come along and messed it up. Right? It wasn't you, but somehow it got all disorderly again. Right? The dust bunnies are back, you know, stuff laying everywhere. Or maybe you buy a new car, right? And 10 years later, your new car is dented and scratched up, and you didn't do that, but somehow your car went to disorder. In fact, your car goes to disorder, and you have to get the oil changed, and all that sort of stuff. Maybe you've even noticed entropy in the mirror, right? It happens there too. It's pretty easy to understand that why entropy happens. I think we probably all have recognized that things change. Well, it turns out when things change, there's a lot more ways for things to change. So it's less orderly than more orderly. Let's say I had a copy of War and Peace. And let's say it was in a loose leaf notebook. And I open the notebook and I pull out all 1,000 pages. And I throw them up in the air. And they come fluttering down. And now I push them back together and I make a nice orderly looking stack. Now, what are the odds that every page is in exactly the right order and right side up and not front to back? I mean, I have a degree in mathematics. I haven't been able to figure out the odds. There's one way for it to be right and gazillion ways for it to be wrong. Okay? So when things change, there's more ways for it to change to go less orderly. And we experience the less orderly and we get bummed out by it. We experience it as dukkha. All right? So what the Buddha is pointing out is dukkha happens. You live in this world, and you're living in a world where entropy is going to happen. And if you're not careful, you're going to experience it as dukkha. Perhaps the broadest understanding of dukkha is that nothing provides lasting happiness. There are certainly things that provide temporary happiness. That soup left today, that was good soup. I like that. I was pretty happy when I finished eating. Tomorrow morning at 7:30, I don't think there's going to be any lasting happiness from the soup, right? I'm going to be wanting breakfast. Right? So nothing provides lasting happiness. Nothing is a source of lasting happiness. This is the broadest meaning of dukkha. But what really gets us is the actual unpleasantness that occurs. And this is why we want to try and deal with the dukkha. Now, the Buddha didn't just stop by saying dukkha happens. He says dukkha arises dependent on craving. That's the second of these ennobling truths. He didn't say craving causes dukkha. He was a genius. He didn't try and figure out why things are happening. He identified the major problem, dukkha, and then he sought a necessary condition for the arising of dukkha, and then he looked to see could he turn off that necessary condition. Now, the idea of necessary condition seems to have not been well known at his time. Necessary condition is, well, the lights, they're on because the light switch is turned on, right? If you want the lights to go off, you just turn off the light switch. You don't have to go blow up the power plant. You don't have to cut the wires coming to the building. Those are also necessary conditions, right? The light switch doesn't make the light shine. Right, that's electrons exciting the filament and all that sort of stuff. But it's a necessary condition. If you can find a necessary condition for something that's happening, and you want whatever it's happening to stop happening, and you can turn off the necessary condition, then whatever you wanted to stop happening stops happening. And so this was what the Buddha did. He didn't try and explain, oh, dukkha arises because in your previous life, or people a long time ago ate an apple, or none of this stuff. He's just simply saying, the problem is dukkha, and it arises dependent on craving. Now, he talked about three kinds of craving. Craving for sense pleasures, right? You want good food to eat, you want to see nice things, you want to hear nice sounds, smell nice things, you want your body to be comfortable, and you want to have happy thoughts, happy emotions, right? And you can crave for that. Dukkha can also arrive what he called bhava tanha or vibhava tanha. Tanha literally means thirst, and it's the word we translate as craving. Bhava tanha would be craving for becoming. So it could be becoming in this life. I want to become rich and famous. Okay? Or it can be becoming in the next life. I want to become a god or a deva. Or I want to become, I want to come back in my next life as a rich person with a Mercedes. All right? This is the kind of becoming that's there. There's also vibhava tanha, craving to not become. So I'm craving not to become sick, right? You get sick, you experience dukkha. Or craving not to become in the next life. So there's too much dukkha here. When I die, I don't want to come back. Now, this craving for becoming in the next life and not becoming in the next life was two of the primary religious goals at the time of the Buddha. The Brahmins, and Brahmanism eventually became Hinduism, the Brahmins taught that basically in your next life, you want to have a better life until eventually you can become union with Brahma, right? So you worked really hard to get a better life. And so they could be craving for a future existence. The Jains, who were another religion at that time, wanted to stop coming back. They wanted to just get rid of all the bad karma so when you died, you didn't come back, right? You were just dead forever, right? So they were craving for not becoming. And, of course, anytime you did anything and it had a result, oh, man, I'm going to have to come back and deal with that, right? Right? So these were the types of spiritual cravings that were going on, as well as the ordinary craving for nice food, pleasant sights, good music, becoming rich and famous, not becoming sick, and so forth. So the Buddha says, yeah, look at this craving. And the third ennobling truth, he says, if you don't crave, the dukkha doesn't happen. Because dukkha arises dependent on craving, if you prevent the craving, then the dukkha can't arise. The craving basically is craving for things to be other than they are. Now, this doesn't mean that if things are not working properly, that you just have to sit there and go, oh, this is the way it is, this is the way it is. All right? If things are not working, then there may be something that you need to do. All right? And you do it, but try not to do it with craving. Right? Sometimes when you do what needs to be done, it still doesn't work. Right? If you get upset at that point, it's just going to be more dukkha. Right? The dukkha the Buddha's talking about is our reactions to what's happening. The Buddha got old, sick, and died. Right? He wasn't able to prevent that from happening, but it didn't bother him. Right? So, yeah, you can't stop your body from aging. Can't stop from getting sick. Well, you can help it by getting exercise and eating good food and so forth. But you can't even stop it from dying. But you can deal with it, right? And this is what the Buddha's talking about. Don't crave for things to be other than they are. If something needs to be done, by all means, do it. Okay, and just deal with the world as it is. Now, if I tell you don't crave, are you going to be able to not crave? You'll probably still get caught up in craving. If the Buddha himself were sitting here and he said, don't crave, you'd probably still get caught in craving. All right? The good news is the fourth of these ennobling truths is the Eightfold Path. The eight practices to undertake such that you can learn to stop craving. The eight practices that bring an end to dukkha. The first of these is samaditti. Sama is usually translated as right, and ditti is view. So, right view. A better translation of sama would be appropriate. So, appropriate view. The word sama actually, in English, we get the word summit from that root. So, the highest, the best, the view that's going to work the best. Now, it's interesting that view would be talked about on the Eightfold Path. The Buddha's teachings were preserved in an oral tradition for about 350 years. The Buddha's disciples memorized what he said, and then they taught that to the next generation, who taught it to the next generation. It went on like this for about 350 years. Until his teachings were written down in Sri Lanka sometime in the first century BC. Now, things sort of change along the way, but there are some teachings that seem to have reached their final stage very early on and didn't really change. And some of these teachings can be found in a collection called the Sutta Nipata, the little Sutta collection is basically what it means. There's five books there. It's about 75 suttas. Book four contains 16 suttas, and that book seems to be the earliest material of all. It appears to have been composed during the first few years of the Buddha's teaching career, and it seems not to have been changed. It was really important stuff. So, for me, that seems to be, all right, this is what the Buddha was really on about. And so, studying these 16 suttas, the overriding theme is not holding to fixed views. Well, this makes sense. If you're not fully awakened right now, if you're not enlightened, you're going to have to change your mind. In order to change your mind, you're going to need an open mind because you're going to have to let go of some of the stuff you've got now to get new stuff. Right? So not holding to fixed views, keeping an open mind, is extremely important. Now, the Buddha didn't say you shouldn't have any views, But whatever view you have, you want to hold it lightly. So when something better comes along, you can let go of that one and pick up the new, better, more useful stuff. So that's one aspect of right view. Other places we find right view defined as the Four Ennobling Truths. It's kind of interesting. Got the four truths, and you get to the fourth one, which is the Noble Eightfold Path, and you get to the first one there, which is right view, and that's defined as the Four Noble Truths. Often when we look at the Buddha's teaching, we see it linearly because it's one word after another, but if you really dig down into it, you often find it's holographic. You dig down a little while and you find the whole thing of it. Quite interesting how he was able to put that out. Now, in other suttas, we find right view defined as dependent origination. Is this a contradiction? Well, no. The Four Noble Truths are, as Ayakema put it, dependent origination in telegram style. Though I guess today we have to say in Twitter style. Right? Just a summary of some of the key points. We'll talk a lot in this retreat about dependent origination and about how it's right view. But basically what the Buddha is saying is look at the world, understand what's going on, and see that everything depends on other things. Nothing exists on its own. And whatever understanding you have, be willing to let it go as you get deeper understanding. Keep an open mind. The second on the Eightfold Path is right intention. What is right intention? Intentions of renunciation, intentions of non-ill will, and intentions of harmlessness. Renunciation. That's kind of tricky. Most people, when they hear renunciation, their reaction is something like, "Get your hands off my stuff." Well, that's our problem. We live in a culture that tells us, you have a problem, you need more stuff. And in fact, I have just exactly the stuff you need. Right? It turns out on the spiritual path, it's not about acquiring stuff. Not physical stuff, not even mental stuff. It's all about letting go. There's nothing to gain on the spiritual path. There's everything to let go of. There's a book in the Tibetan tradition called Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. Big old thick book. Kind of interesting, but definitely the best part is the title. Because you see, we all do have liberation in the palm of our hands. You can see that. Make a fist. Come on, everybody make a fist. Hold it up in front of your face. Now, you want to see liberation? Look at the palm of your hand. How you get there. Alright? Keep this in mind. This is what renunciation is about. Now, it's true as lay people, we need more than three robes and a bowl. Alright? That's what the monks got by with in the time of the Buddha. But we do need to come to terms with our stuff. Often people find that, well, it's their birthday, somebody gives them a nice piece of artwork. They're going to hang it. Their walls are already clogged with artwork. Or they give them somebody gives you some nice clothes. You can't get it into your closet because it's full. Ayakema said that every 6 months you should go through all of your clothes and anything you haven't worn, give it to charity. It's not going to come back in style. You're not going to lose those pounds. All right, let it go. Unburden yourself. Right? Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Right? There's a lot of wisdom in some of this early Dharma called rock and roll. Alright, so we need to come to terms with our stuff. I mean, I know people can't get their car in their garage because it's too full of stuff. Right? And people got so much stuff they go down the street to rent a room someplace where they put the other stuff that they don't need all the time. Right? We're totally inundated with stuff. So, one of the things that's really important to realize is that the future generations have not given us permission to use up all of the world's resources. And if we're using up the world's resources with stuff, this is actually taking what's not given. Right? So you want to live lightly. You want to live simply so that others can simply live. And this is what renunciation is about for lay people. And then non-ill will and harmlessness. Or we could translate them positively as love and compassion. I mentioned last night that we're vastly interconnected. This acting in harmony with this interconnection is acting with love and compassion. Wishing the best for others, doing what you can to, help them have a good life. And if you encounter dukkha, do what you can to alleviate the dukkha. So these are the intentions that we have. Think about what the world would be like if everybody on the planet, their intentions, their motivation was letting go, being loving, helping out. It'd be a really different world. I kind of like to live in that world. Well, the only way we're going to get that kind of world is if we start acting that way ourselves. So these are the three right intentions. These first two are usually referred to as the wisdom aspect of the Eightfold Path. And the next three are the sila, the ethics of the Eightfold Path. The first of these is right speech. We talked about right speech last night, to not tell lies, to not use harsh or abusive speech, to not be divisive, to be a peacemaker rather than cause division, and not to engage in gossip or idle chatter. In some of the suttas, the Buddha lists what he considers unedifying conversations, conversations that, are a waste of time. Conversations about kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, wars. Food, drink, beds, clothing, garlands, perfumes. Relatives, carriages, villages, towns, cities, countries. Talk about heroes. Talk about men or women. Talk of by the well. Talk of the departed, useless chatter, speculations about land and sea, talk of being and non-being. Doesn't leave a lot. Kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, wars. Well, that's the 6 o'clock dukkha report. You have the 6 o'clock dukkha report here on TV, right? Yeah, they do everywhere I go, right? They turn it on. In Afghanistan today, there was dukkha. In the Ukraine, there was dukkha. In Africa, there was dukkha. Right here in Finland, there was dukkha. The parliament tried to pass a law to alleviate dukkha, but it only made things worse. We'll be back with the weather. Right? It's important to know what's going on in the world, but you don't need to completely lose yourself in the dukkha reports. Food, clothing, drinks, beds, garlands, perfumes. You go to a newsstand. How many magazines are about all these things? Carriages. In America, we have Car and Driver. We have automobile magazines. Villages, towns, countries, cities. National Geographic. I like that one. All the travel magazines. Relatives. Oh, there's a good topic to talk about. Men or women, heroes. That's like sports stars, pop stars, celebrity gossip. I mean, you go on the internet and you could spend the rest of your life and not be able to read all the rest of the celebrity gossip. What kind of life is that? I mean, do you really care about these people? The Buddha basically said that pay attention to what you're talking about. There's a lot of ways you can waste your time with just talking. Now, as lay people, some people we relate to, we kind of relate on that level. I had a couple of friends at work that, they were sports nuts. And so I'd go in, we'd talk sports. Though the idea was that if I found a way to move the conversation to a higher level, try and do that. So if you're engaged in talking about ice hockey or celebrities or politics or whatever, and you find a way to move the conversation to a higher level, by all means do so. The next on the Eightfold Path is right action. Right action is defined as not killing, not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct. So in two of the Eightfold Path, we have four of the precepts. You might be wondering about the fifth precept on intoxicants. The Buddha's giving this talk to five guys living on one grain of rice a day. No problem with intoxicants. He didn't actually make that precept later until he had lay followers. So this is what got mentioned in the Eightfold Path. The last of the ethical behavior on the Eightfold Path is right livelihood. Making a living in a way that doesn't involve breaking one of the precepts or causing somebody else to break a precept. So if you don't drink alcohol, but you work in a liquor store, it would be considered wrong livelihood because you're encouraging other people to drink intoxicants. Sometimes it's very clear that your livelihood is a nice livelihood. You're helping people out, you're a doctor or whatever. Sometimes it's very clear it's not. The Buddha actually listed some wrong livelihoods, being a slave trader, being a weapons trader, dealing in poison, being a mercenary, being in the army for hire, being a thief, being a gambler. But sometimes it's not really easy to tell. When I was working as a computer programmer, I worked for a company that made a database. Database, that's like a filing cabinet. That's harmless, right? Well, except look at the customers. California Water Resources Board, University of California, General Electric, Pentagon. I was glad when I got a different job. Okay? Look at how you're making a living. Is what you're doing to earn your keep making the world a better place, or is it making the world a worse place? Long as it's not making it worse, it's considered right livelihood. And then the last three on the Eightfold Path are the samadhi aspect, the concentration or indistractability aspect. The first of these is right effort. Right effort, there's really two ways of looking at it. One is not striving too hard and not being too loose, not goofing off. There's the famous sutta about the young man who was raised in a very luxurious environment. It says he had hair growing on the soles of his feet. He was so delicate. Right? And so he became a monk, and he was practicing walking meditation, and his feet were bleeding and everything, and he was like, I can't do this. I'm going to go home. He went to see the Buddha to say farewell. And the Buddha says, did you ever play the lute? And being a rich man, of course he played the lute. The Buddha says, well, Sona, what happened if you tightened the strings very tight? Oh, it didn't sound very good. What if you made them really loose? It still didn't sound very good. How did you make it sound good? Oh, it was in the middle. Okay, this is what you need to do with your effort. Got to do it in the middle. This is why I talk about relaxed diligence. If you do too much relax, that's the strings too loose. If you do too much diligence, that's the strings too tight. You got to find that middle way in there. Do the practice, but keep a relaxed attitude around it. So the right amount of effort is part of right effort. But there are also the four great efforts. To make an arisen, unwholesome state of mind go away. That's the first. Second, to prevent an unarisen, unwholesome state of mind from arising. Third, to make an unarisen, wholesome state of mind arise. And the fourth, to make an arisen, wholesome state of mind stick around and come to perfection. I give you an example. You're driving on the motorway, and some idiot cuts you off. And the next thing you know, you're screaming four-letter words at your windshield, right? Okay, an unwholesome state of mind has arisen. So you realize that, okay, antidote for anger and ill will is metta. May you learn to drive. May you arrive safely at your destination. Okay, so you made the unwholesome state of mind go away. All right, you continue driving down the motorway, and some other idiot cuts you off. And you're just about to start screaming four-letter words at your windshield, and may you learn to drive. Mm-hmm. All right, you prevented the unwholesome state of mind from arising. But you've also made a wholesome state of mind arise, right? That's number three. So keep it around. May we all arrive safely at our destination. May there be no roadworks. May there be no traffic jams, right? Bring it to perfection. So these four great efforts to make the unwholesome go away and keep it from coming back. Make the wholesome arise and keep it around. These are the four great efforts. The seventh on the Eightfold Path is right mindfulness. And what is right mindfulness? It's the four establishments of mindfulness, or sometimes translated four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the Vedana, the pleasant, unpleasant categorization of a sensory input. Just the immediate categorization as to pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The third is mindfulness of your mind states. Are you happy, sad, confused, concentrated, whatever? Just knowing your state of mind. And then the fourth, mindfulness of dharmas. Dharma is an interesting word. You see it with a capital D in singular, it refers to the Buddha's teaching or to the truth with a capital T. Now, of course, a capital D for Dharma, that's just the translator trying to help you out because Pali didn't have an alphabet. It was just an oral language. But when you see Dharmas with a little D in plural, it probably usually means phenomena. So the fourth establishment of mindfulness is mindfulness of phenomena. In particular, mindfulness of phenomena with respect to the Buddhist teachings. We'll go into this in more detail as we get further into the retreat. And then the eighth on the Eightfold Path is right concentration, sama samadhi, or appropriate indistractability, to be more accurate. And what is right concentration? Secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, one enters and remains in the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. This is right concentration. The Buddha defined the eighth of the Eightfold Path as the first four jhanas. Now, when the Buddha got to the end of this talk, he looked at the group of five, and he could see that one of them, Kandanya by name, got it. He understood. The Buddha got kind of excited. He said, "You know, Kandanya. You know, don't you, Kandanya?" Which in Pali is something like Anya Kandanya. And indeed, Kandanya did know. He knew that all that arises also ceases. We owe a great debt of gratitude to Kandanya. Can you imagine if the Buddha got to the end of his discourse, looks at the five guys, and they go, "So?" He'd have gone back and sat under the Bodhi tree and just enjoyed the bliss of enlightenment for 45 years. But somebody understood. He could teach this. And so he kept teaching. And over the next few weeks, one by one, each of the other guys got it. They reached the first level of awakening called stream entry. And then when he knew their minds were well prepared, he taught them what we have come to know as the second discourse, the discourse on not self. And at the end of that discourse, all five of them were fully awakened. But we'll have to save that for another time. Mm-hmm.